But I think what happens with mystical experiences, and certainly this is true in my experience, is it becomes overpowering. So the overpowering emotion is kind of love, actually. I mean, it sounds very cheesy.
Welcome to the Deadly Departed podcast, where the veil between the living and the dead is just a whisper away. I'm Jock, and along with my colleagues in Paranormal Daily News, we will be your guides through the shadowy realms of the paranormal and the unexplained. In each episode, we will dive into the eerie and the enigmatic with the help of today's leading experts in parapsychology, science, and the supernatural. Prepare to uncover the secrets that lurk in the dark and explore the mysteries that defy explanation. Let's embark on this journey now. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Jock here. This is Deadly Departed, and I am delighted to be joined with my guest again for part two. Matt Colburn, and we're talking about, well, not just his book, we're talking about all sorts of things. There's a lot of gems in the book. By the way, if nobody's, I now have my copy and Matt's got his copy, obviously, because he wrote it, but you know, links are in the description. If you haven't listened to our first episode, go and listen to it. It's phenomenal. There's so much to unpack, and actually might even be a part three in this. And as we're sitting here now, there's terrible things are going on in the world. Iran has just gone to war with Israel. Let's not even talk about politics, but there's so much going on here in the States with division and hatred and decisiveness, you know, and maybe our mystical experiences, maybe just that transpersonal vision that we can have, is to quote Stanislav Grof, is a key to us getting through some of the worst times in life as well. And obviously, these questions, you know, do we have free will? I seen a post recently where a scientist just says that's total illusion, which really kind of, I was disturbed by it, to say the least. Another thing that Matt actually looks at, and the hard problem of consciousness. Anyway, without further ado, let's go straight into it. Matt, welcome back, my friend.
Well, I'm very glad to be back, Jock. Thank you very much.
And like I said, you know, I'm still getting through the book, but it's fascinating because it is academic, but it's not academic, right? I really enjoy it, but there's so much, I think, to unpack from this book, including even mental health is something that we're going to talk about as well. Let's talk about this idea of and let people understand. You know, there's a part of the book we talk about David Chalmers in 1995. Mm-hmm. You know, we all know, you know, from our studies, the hard problem of consciousness, materialist point of view, and maybe the realm of experience. There's going to be people out there that don't know what that is, and they're not going to read the paper. So let's talk a little bit about consciousness and experience.
Okay, so you're talking about what's probably the most technical chapter in the book, but I
know
hopefully still accessible, but yeah, definitely the most technical chapter. So the hard problem of consciousness was raised by I think he's Australian philosopher David Chalmers back in 1994, and he was basically saying that you've got brain function going on when people have conscious experiences. So conscious experiences are basically any experience you want to think about. So I'm having a conscious experience recording this podcast. You're having a conscious experience watching or listening to it.
Absolutely.
And it's anything like watching a blue sky, I don't know, tasting a sandwich that you're eating, hearing waves on the shore, anything, any kind of experience, really. So that's experience. And we know that when people have conscious experiences, there's an awful lot of things going on in their brains. So they're essentially getting information from their sensory systems, like their eyes or their ears or their skin or nose or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's being processed in the brain, so you can actually hook people up to an EEG, or you can put them in a neuroimaging machine, and you can see that there are correlations with those conscious experiences. So for example, when people are seeing things, there's a lot of activity at the back of their brains, because that's where the visual images are processed in sort of very by specialist cells, essentially. But there's a big gap between that kind of processing and the actual experience of seeing. So, like I said, you could be watching, I don't know, the waves rolling on a beach, or you could be watching the seagulls wheeling in the air, and all of those things will be happening in your brain. But no one understands how that produces the experience of actually seeing the waves or watching the seagulls or hearing them. And that's that gap is, it's been called an explanatory gap. And David Chalmers essentially called that the hard problem of consciousness. So it's the problem of how do all of these electrochemical processes in the brain produce experience?
You know, and what's interesting is obviously materialists have a hard line on this. Every experience that they have, they say, is in the brain, and obviously then it doesn't kind of explain mystical experiences and how we are experiencing maybe even a transpersonal aspect. And, you know, so let's unpack that a little bit as well, because I think David Chalmers was onto something when he, you know, obviously went to the conferences in Tucson. And it was interesting because, and what you highlight is that when they were at that conference, everything was about the brain. Everything was about everything coming from the brain. And it kind of poo-pooed and just negated, just nobody, every other experience is just doesn't exist. It's not there. But yet we know that people's experiences go far beyond the brain. I mean, we know from a lot of the research that we alluded to before in our last podcast, the split brain and obviously how near-death experiences when someone is confirmed dead and has these experiences outside of themselves that are, and I want to say, are evidential in nature. You know, we just need to look at Dr. Parnham's research as well, and then experiences from potential materialist scientists that were, and I want to talk about, were materialists but now are not, like Dr. Marjorie Woollacott, who's also going to be one of our guests here. Fantastic idea as well, where she has had these experiences that have gone beyond the brain and was a neuroscientist, and so it challenges the paradigm here massively.
Well, first of all, I'll say that we're sort of in an era that's actually, I think I said last time, where increasingly, even in mainstream sort of neuroscience, attention is being paid to what we might call mystical experiences, transpersonal experiences, experiences that go beyond the person, and also, of course, near-death experiences. But I think what tends to happen is that, again, there's a sort of filter operating where those experiences are increasingly acknowledged and investigated sort of scientifically. But the really challenging anomalous parts of them tend to be excluded. So they can be examined pretty much in terms of just being brain function. So we talked about near deaths a bit last time, but let's have a look at the sort of psychedelic revival. So there's an awful lot of research being done at the moment on psychedelics, and particularly psychedelics for therapeutic purposes. So things like psilocybin and DMT are being used therapeutically to treat things like trauma, depression, alcoholism, with some success, actually. And so, for example, in Imperial College London is probably the nearest place to where I'm sitting, where that research is going on, but it's happening all over the place. Sussex as well now has a psychedelic. Wow. Yeah, so, but if you actually read the research that comes out of it, it's all, again, pretty strict neuroscience. So there is what happens is explanations are made in terms of brain function only. And in fact, I think it may be a big thing. I'm not sure which YouTube channel it's on, but there's actually one with a psychedelics researcher saying there's nothing supernatural about mystical and transpersonal experiences. It's just that what happens is they have an effect on your brain and you're more aware of what's going on in your brain. And that's essentially the explanation. So it's, again, it's very much an individualized take on what's going on. And there are researchers like Robin Carhart-Harris who has had what's called the entropic brain theory. So entropy is basically noise in the brain. And his idea was that entropy increases during, say, when you take LSD, and that sort of, it gets your brain out of sort of unhealthy grooves. So during depression, for example, people tend to ruminate a lot, and that's associated with the overactive, I think it's medial cortex, but also the default mode network, and people get stuck in loops of patterns of unhealthy thinking and destructive thinking. And the idea is that psychedelics are able to actually hook you out of that. So these experiences are being acknowledged, but the transpersonal and post-materialist aspects of them are quite often being downplayed or outright denied still, I think.
Now, what about, so here's where I get confused, and I'm very lucky, ladies and gentlemen, that I will be moving forward in my grief research and my dissertation, working with Dr. Pascal Emmanuel Michael on grief and awakening experiences and the use of psychedelics, which I don't know a lot about, but I have spoken to people. And what I want to challenge is there's, because I never experienced it myself, but there are people that I've spoken to who have said that they're utilizing the psychedelics to have a transpersonal experience.
Yeah.
And I've asked them, have you connected with a deceased loved one? Have you connected with a being? And have you got evidence from that? Now, obviously, it hasn't been empirical evidence, which hopefully we'll get to research a bit more. But there have been some claims of people that are saying, okay, I have utilized this. I have connected with my loved one on the other side. I have got what she terms or he terms is evidence. Now that to me challenges a little bit of this materialist idea of it being in the brain. Because yep. Now we have a discarnate being that is connecting with you on a mystical level, on a transpersonal level, that is given potential evidence, potential, and you know, one man's evidence is another man's failure. I know that. So all you scientists are going to attack me for this. But there is an element that they are getting something. They're getting something that's directly attributable to their lives or answers a question or gives them some kind of evidence from the other side. That to me is fascinating because it really does challenge this idea, this assumption that these psychedelics only just work in the brain and they're having this brain effect. What would you say to that, Matt?
Yeah, I'd say there's more than an element of cultural bias in this research. Ayahuasca is known as the vine of the dead for a reason.
I didn't even know it was known as that. Yeah. But and, that is so poignant.
Yeah. So, but also, I think I actually mentioned in the chapter, because there's a chapter in the book on In What Lies Beyond on mystical experience, but also I look at the psychedelic controversies. And there's so many, for a start, anecdotal accounts of apparent telepathy, clairvoyance, precognition, but also these entity encounters. And actually, these again are coming under scientific scrutiny. And there's a number of theories sort of to explain them. So I think one of the main researchers who's been looking into these more challenging aspects has been David Luke, and I think his book Otherworlds, he talks about possible explanations for these entity encounters. So there's obviously the hallucination theory. So we know that hallucinations can be extremely lifelike at times.
But can they give you? Can it be intelligent hallucinations that give you evidence that kind of? This is the quite. This
well,
is
that's the, where the, we're starting to cross the boundary.
Yeah.
I call it, well, after Walter Franklin Prince called he wrote a book called The Enchanted Boundary. And he was sort of basically, it was a a summary of sort of all the strange things otherwise critical thinking scientists tended to say when they started discussing psychical research. So I sort of adopted that when writing the book, because I thought that's a really nice word for this boundary. So on one side of it, you've got materialistic explanations, and then on the other side of it, you've got all the stuff that's generally dismissed as woo-woo and dodgy. But again, it's quite insulting, I think, to experiences to do that, particularly if they're very personally significant experiences. Yeah. And also, if they're potentially evidential. I mean, I think David actually did a summary of some of the psi experiments, so actually looking for evidence of things like telepathy during psychedelics.
That's fascinating to me.
Yeah, I mean, not that much work has been done, actually, and I think it's an area of undone research. There needs to be more, and I think there is more research being done on...
Maybe I'll add that into my dissertation, Levin. It sounds like a good angle to go in there.
So I think, and they're doing stuff not just with psychedelics, but with flotation tanks. So I think Mark Vittman's doing that. And
I've heard of that, I think you mentioned that before as well. Do you think then that the psychedelic experience, the mystical experiences from there, is there a crossover to parapsychology, the study of parapsychology?
100%.
Yeah.
And I think this is something, again, it's a slight academic kind of boxes and also slight snobbery. There's been a separation of mystical experience from ostensible psi phenomena, which I don't believe is justified at all. And I think I mentioned last time Paul Marshall's work on that.
Yeah, actually you did.
But I see them as basically two sides of the same coin, because you have paranormal experiences that turn into mystical experiences and mystical experiences that turn to paranormal experiences. So you could say that they're distinct but definitely highly correlated experiences. And if you look at Sir Alistair Hardy, who is a great biologist in the 60s.
I think Jack Hunter has done a lot of stuff in that.
Yeah, he actually founded a database of sort of religious and mystical experiences. And if you actually look in that database, a lot of those experiences are just straight paranormal experiences. So they tend to get lumped together. So perhaps we should just explain a bit so mystical experiences are, there are different kinds. So there's, for example, the extroverted mystical experience, where you might be, I don't know, in a natural setting, and suddenly your consciousness shifts and the experience becomes incredibly intense, and the world seems very alive. It seems pulsing with intelligence.
Yeah.
And then there are introverted mystical experiences, which might happen when you're meditating or in trance, or basically when your attention's turned inwards, and you might again have an experience of cosmic love, a cosmic consciousness, again this sense of an intelligent, benign, all-pervading presence. So those are basically what mystical experiences are, and they're all over the place. Psychic experiences tend to be slightly different. So you might be having a mystical experience and then suddenly get, I don't know, the precognition of something that's going to happen tomorrow, or you might feel you get a message from somewhere else.
Yeah.
So that would be, so you can see they're distinct but related. And the point is, I think, that the kind of mystical state of consciousness seems to be more conducive to psi phenomena. Although, again, we need better evidence of that.
And that's the problem. We need empirical evidence from it, and that's what I'm fascinated with. But also there's an element of discernment here that we need as well, because I've seen I've experienced, and I've spoken to many other people in my kind of years of research as well, that between an anomalous experience or a mystical experience, there's an element of discernment that it seems to me that's missed, because some people will claim a mystical experience that really isn't. And it's something maybe they're fabricating in their own mind. Case in point, someone has a near-death experience and it's very vivid, it's very real, it's different to a vivid dream, but maybe they come back, as you know, as Dr. Penny Sartori had mentioned in her books as well, where there was evidence, there was an empirical evidence point to it, where there's other people that will go into a meditation, claim that they're having a near-death experience, or the some of it seems fabricated. Is there a way that do you think that we can create some kind of framework that discerns between what is a legitimate experience, mystical experience? Mm-hmm. Now, anomalous experiences, we do have frameworks, and what we can measure and the epistemology of it, how we understand it, it that has a framework. But we're missing that in the transpersonal side of things, which I think as well, what your book, you know, this quick flash of What Lies Beyond alludes to in here, guys. We're missing, and maybe we need a new framework to be able to discern and identify what is a real mystical experience, because I don't think we have it.
I think, strictly speaking, you're probably right, actually, and it dovetails with how do we distinguish healthy experiences from, say, mental health, you know, mental illness.
Absolutely.
Frankly. So say manic. It's called bipolar disorder now, but say the manic state in bipolar disorder, and I think that's an important and very relevant question. And again, it sort of opens up a whole can of worms, which we can possibly unpack to mix metaphors.
We definitely want to unpack this. We spoke about this just before we started, so we're going to unpack it.
I tend to go back to the writings of William James. Now
William James,
late 19th century, early 20th century, founder of psychology and also a great sort of philosopher as well. He did a series of lectures which came out as the book Varieties of Religious Experience.
Brilliant,
absolutely brilliant.
Love it still
today. And that was looking at a lot of things, but it focused on mystical experiences. And at the beginning of it, he talks about how you, by their fruits ye shall know them.
Exactly.
And that's essentially a pragmatic approach. So it doesn't say, is this real or isn't it a real experience? It says, what are its benefits? How does it make our life better to experience this? And I think that's an important take, because we can...
And that's also frustrating, certainly for me as well, Matt. It's kind of frustrating because whilst I do, like, you know, Jung was pragmatic as well as Groff, Saggioli, which I also see from a recent evidential point of view, there was lack of, for me, there needs to be some kind of evidence, even in pragmatism, because that seems to be something that is lost as well. As we just say, well, it's pragmatic, let's just, you know, just accept it for the benefits it has. But I don't think that's good enough.
I take your point, and actually I've had a similar conversation with Jack Hunter, because we were talking about how in anthropology you can do what's it called? I think it's phenomenological bracketing or something. But basically you try and just approach experiences, and you don't worry about whether they're real or not, or what their ultimate nature is. You try and just look at the experience. And Jack was saying, it's very nice in theory, but in practice, if you're, say, attending a seance and you have an anomalous experience, the question of whether it's real and what's actually going on is going to come up. So, I mean, I think that was in response to some of the experiences he had, because he did his doctorate on a medium circle, and I think he had a couple of anomalous experiences there.
I know that circle actually, right. and I was kind of I tested in that circle as well.
So
Jack and I have a connection for, because I knew him when he was a student.
I
didn't meet him, but I knew of him, and so when I got to LEF and I seen him, I was like, name sounds a bell, you know, and then you do, you're like, oh my god, it's him.
Yeah, it's I mean, it is a small world.
Bristol Spirit Lodge.
Yeah. Yes, that's the one.
Yeah.
That's the one. So I think you're right. You do have to look for something more. But I think at the same time, I don't know. When I pray, because, I mean, you know, I've had mystical experiences of varying degrees of intensity. And I have had moments where I've wondered whether it's just my brain firing off in strange ways. And but then at the same time, I think
let's dive in, because I think that's important, because from a researcher's point of view and your mystical experience.
Well, sure.
I mean,
I think. Yeah. So first of all, they come in various degrees of intensity. I mean, I had one particularly strong one about 15 years ago, and that was introvertive. That was actually, it was in a legal setting, but it was with, I'm not going to go into details of it, but basically it was with aid. yeah, it's actually the one that's mentioned in chapter one of my book. But I would actually point more to the ones I've sort of had in nature, which have generally been less intense. At times they've reached sort of what I would call an extroverted, where you get what happens is that your consciousness shifts and you suddenly become aware of a deep interconnection with the living world. And the world feels very animated and alive. I mean, I think you can get a low-level idea of this just going into woodland in summer. I mean, yesterday I was walking around.
Yeah.
So this is definitely a spectrum. But I think what happens with mystical experiences, and certainly this is true in my experiences, is it becomes overpowering. So the overpowering emotion is kind of love, actually. I mean, it sounds very cheesy.
I get it. No, I mean, it can sound cheesy, but no, I get that, because is there another way to describe it? Probably not. No. It's very difficult to describe.
I mean, the thing is, as well, I think the precursor to that is your sense of self dissolves. So,
absolutely, yeah.
So, I think that's something that's been noted in the neuroscience literature, actually, and they very much latch onto that. So in the debates they were having with Bernardo Kastrup over whether these were really evidence of post-material transpersonal stuff, they were going, well, we know the self, the bits of the brain that keep the self sense of self in order, which is the default mode network, they tend to go down, and there's a dissolution of the sense of self that's correlated with that. And I thought that's fine, but that's only stage one. And it's the same problem that I have with the entropic brain theory, that it's negative. It's going, well, fine, that's going down. And you've got brain noise going up a tiny bit. I mean, but you're downplaying this sense of a doorway being opened. And it's from William Blake, actually, but via Aldous Huxley, the doors of perception open.
Oh, yeah. I've studied some of Aldous Huxley's works as well, actually.
Yeah. So he was writing about this in the 50s and 60s. And he took, I think it's mescaline, and wrote about it in the doors of perception. But it's the same experience. You get heightened significance, and you get this deep sense of interconnectedness. I get this deep sense of animation, like the entire universe is animated. The thing
Steve Taylor has had experiences like that as well.
I've got a lot of sympathy for his sort of awakening idea that this is all about awakening. And actually, I think that's just basically what we're talking about, these stages of awakening. And that's contrasted with the idea that everyday life is a sleep, which I have a lot of. I think I have a lot of sympathy for that idea. I think that's basically true, that we all of us go through everyday life most of the time in a state of trance, and our consciousness
that's interesting, is it? And it's almost like then when you have that experience that you're crossing that veil, or just that portal just boom blasts open, and then you have a taste of what is reality, in a sense.
That's right. And it's been called lots of different things by lots of different traditions and authors. Yeah. So, you know, Colin Wilson called it power consciousness. Blake, the doors of perception are being cleansed, and then you see everything as it is in infinite. The Romantics, other Romantics talked about it, like William Wordsworth in his poem Intimations of Immortality, which talks about how luminous the world is when you're a kid.
Yeah.
And then as you grow up, the prison bars descend. And that links into what we were also talking about, which was the experience of depression, which is something that I have unfortunately firsthand experienced. That up,
because I mean, we've all experienced depression at some point in our lives. I have as well. I suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder, which I have to say, ladies and gentlemen, before we get, you know, I had PTSD from things I was involved in the past, and I dealt with it through mystical experiences and transpersonal experiences. So there is something that we want to unpack here in terms of mental health and mystical experience, and I think the book is a great segue onto that as well. But what I think is amazing and quite courageous, Matt, is the fact that you're not shy about saying I'm struggling here.
Do
you think your mystical, well, let me ask this, because this is a bit weird, do you think your mystical experiences have helped you with your mental health, or challenged you, or even hindered you?
I'd say on balance they've definitely helped,
right?
But it's a slightly complicated story, but I think there are connections between having, say, a nervous breakdown and having a spiritual breakthrough. And we talk about spiritual crisis, and there's a great debate on how do you distinguish between a plain old-fashioned nervous breakdown, which I know it's not a clinical phrase, but people tend to understand what you're talking about.
No, exactly.
And a mystical breakthrough, which can look at the same, because obviously, and I think Steve Taylor's actually written a whole book on it.
People, it's brilliant. I've read his books. Great. I've got all his books, actually.
People can have.
Oh, I'm spiritual. A fanboy or anything, but yeah. I do.
Oh, me too. I've got, you know, they're on my shelf.
Good.
But I mean, yes. So basically, there's another book by, I think it's Raphael Rezazeek. He's a psychiatrist, and it's published by Watkins, actually. So it's called Breaking Down is Waking Up.
Oh, I need to take a note of that. I didn't know.
Yeah, it's a really illuminating book, because he's a psychiatrist. And so he cites in that book some work that shows that spiritual interest tends to get inflated with people with mental health problems. And I really understand that, because one of the hallmarks of depression, certainly for me, but I think for a lot of other people, is that the world, it's like the polar opposite of a mystical experience. The world becomes totally drained of meaning.
And you can
describe that in ways. It becomes heavy, clodded, disconnected, mechanical, all of those words. Actually, Philip K. Dick, the science fiction writer, called it the tomb world, which I think is actually quite
poignant as well. Like,
analogy. Had his own he had some very severe mental health problems, but the thing is that what also happens when people go through sort of trauma and mental health problems is that their self, their ego, often gets challenged.
Yeah.
Now, you'll know from mystical, from some religious and sort of the wisdom traditions, particularly Buddhism.
Yes.
That the transcending the ego is one of the hallmarks of people trying to induce mystical experiences at will. But that also happens when people experience mental health problems. And so quite often those two things are considered separate. But actually, I think what he's saying is basically, this is not, by the way, to romanticize mental illness, which can be really horrible. And I do not recommend the pathway. No, I think that's important.
It's not one to take.
But we do need to be responsible with this, though.
You have to, yeah.
But I think the point he's making is that actually, you're in both cases, whether you're having significant mental, you know, sort of ego problems because of trauma or mental health problems, or whether you're facing that kind of dissolution in, I don't know, deep meditational practice or whatever, it's both of those are challenging the ego. And so there does seem to be a relation there, although it's sort of tricky. But I think in the book, he actually has a little diagram on this is the pathological pathway, and this is the more healthy pathway. And I think we definitely want to be encouraging that the healthy pathway, because obviously, I think one thing you'll know from your work on bereavement that when, you know, mental illness to one side, if you put someone through grief or a major loss, their sense of self is quite often challenged, and that can happen.
Absolutely. There's such a sense of disconnection.
Yes. So a relationship breakup could do it, losing your job.
It's important because people think, you know, we talk about grief and bereavement and mystical experiences from it. They just think about death and dying. But in reality, everyone suffers an element of grief, you know, just from now. Like we spoke about this before in the past, you know, you and I, you know, I went through Hurricane Helene here and I witnessed so much grief. And yes, I witnessed people that were grieving through loss of loved ones that just disappeared in the flood. But I also witnessed people that were suffering terrible and developing PGD, prolonged grief disorder from it. Post-traumatic growth. I get the two of them mixed up, but PGD. And that could be just from losing the business, losing their self of identity, losing their jobs, losing, you know, friendships. So there's so much that correlates in mental health and these and mystical experiences. And interestingly, and I've noticed as well with people that have a sense of loss and disconnection, they're ripe for a mystical experience.
I think there's, again, I'm conscious of being very careful here because I don't think either of us are advocating an irresponsible approach to mental illness. It needs to be taken very seriously.
Yeah.
If people need support, they should for sure get it, of any of the kind of support that they need.
And absolutely, people should reach out. They should, counselors and doctors. But also, I think there's a massive issue, Matt, and I don't know how you feel about it, but I think mental illness gets often pathologized wrongly as well, because there is a correlation to mystical experience, spiritual crisis, as we've seen through work with Groff and a synthesis with Saggioli. There's elements where I think that's not a mental health issue. That's a spiritual issue. That's a mystical experience issue.
Yes, absolutely. And that's where spiritual crisis comes in. But to sort of come back to my own personal experience, which is probably the most reliable guide for me, and for me, that you asked whether it had made a difference. And I would say that for me, I went through a period of quite bad depression when I was doing my PhD, actually.
Oh, and wow.
It was coincided with I started beginning to seriously question materialistic approaches again in that period. And for me, recovery meant that sort of worldview shift away from a purely materialistic perspective.
Do you think that was
very practical reasons? Sorry?
Do you think that was a catalyst, because your paradigm changed, that whole worldview changed to you, and that was the catalyst to depression?
Yeah, what I'll say, it was about the most inconvenient time to do it, because I was doing a PhD at about the most materialistic place in the world.
I'm not laughing at it, but it is quite funny when you think about it.
it is, looking back, but it was sort of quite harrowing at the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was very difficult because I was wanting to do the basically spiritual inquiry in a place that basically saw you as, this isn't supposed to be overly negative, but there are definite biases and you're not supposed to ask those sorts of questions if you're doing serious cognitive science work. And that took me a long time to resolve in my head. But sort of after that, I had a difficult few years. But one of the things that got me through was this sense that I am not just my feelings. I am not just my material body. There is some aspect of me that is transpersonal.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that survives death. I have an open mind on that, but I haven't had experiences that strongly suggest to me survival, although I've certainly looked for them. I mean, I went to sort of mediums and various things, and obviously I've read, you know, it's one reason
that's
why I'm interested in the reincarnation.
You look at mediums giving evidence, and often is something, there's a lot of the time evidence is given really probably wouldn't stand up, because I've always said one man's evidence, another man's failure. But have you witnessed enough mediumship to make you question the validity of you know, consciousness, continuing after death? Or what is the thing that to you is like, I still don't get it. You know, I still don't.
Yeah, I think actually the closest that comes to it, and Ken Wilber said this. He said that quite often he thinks people are looking for the wrong thing sometimes, and that if you, the more you meditate, and I have to say this does feed into my experience definitely, you do get the sense that there is some aspect of you that is not subject to, you know, aging, illness, and death, the three big ones the Buddha was talking about.
Right.
It more operates on a kind of instinctive level. But at the same time, I'm obviously interested in evidence for survival. I mean, I sort of sit on the survival committee with the SBR that's mostly approving grants, but survival is definitely of interest. But I think the actual evidence in psychical research is often quite difficult to interpret, and there are multiple. So we talked about near deaths, but then we also talked about the reincarnation, but also the best of mediumship, I think, a little bit last time. So it's quite tough to interpret those pieces of evidence, but I would say it's definitely worthwhile. I mean, there's a wealth of fascinating material there. But if I had to say what would tip the balance for me, it would be more that personal sense.
That experience, that your personal experience.
Just something that transcends your...
Right.
You know, the sort of fact that we're impermanent beings in an impermanent universe. And I think that sense of transcendence, on whatever level that happens. But I had a chat with... I keep referring back to my podcast. Do you listen? But
podcast. You know, What Lies Beyond podcast. Just quick thing for the book. It is a great podcast. I've listened to it. I love it as well. But don't just listen to Deadly Departed.
Yeah,
you'll get. You know, there's some great conversations on there.
But I mean, the one I had with Jem Bendel, where he said it was a good thing, maybe that we don't know ultimately, and that sometimes maybe there's an aspect of clinging if we cling on to a particular idea about what might happen afterwards. And I think he was approaching it from a Buddhist point of view. So in terms of contemplation, when you meditate, you become more aware of habits that are perhaps not helping you or holding you back. And I think that I tend to think that our theories about the world are a bit flimsy and feeble. It's one reason I think why people get so emotional about about them and want to be certain about things. And but if we're really honest with ourselves and we take a deep breath and go, what do we actually know? Quite often, I think it's more a hope, isn't it, than an actual knowledge, which is okay. But it,
you know, I think I can challenge that, because I think there's an element of, I've always maintained, and you've probably heard this from loads of other people, the difference between a skeptic and a believer is just pure experience, right? So whilst I get to the point where I'm like, you know, in my past, I've thought, you know, is there an afterlife? Is these experiences real? But then at the same time, the experiences that I have, I would say, and I say this a lot, I don't believe in anything. I work towards knowing. Right, I don't want to believe in anything because it implies a disbelief based on someone else's perceptions and expectations. A learned behavior that you get, well, you should believe that this is what it is. In terms of the experiences I've had, I unequivocally do, and I will use the term, I'm going to get hell for this, I do know that the afterlife exists, primarily because of those experiences, subjective as well as objective, so that have given evidence. And I think there's and that's maybe where a lot of the problems I had with my own biases and my own research and writing papers and things. But I definitely think that your experience that you can have, and even if I look back to these experiences, there's no way that I can explain them. And so I've come to a place in my life where I think I can say, yeah, I know. And I unequivocally know. So I kind of don't live in hope. But I think as well, though, that helps me to maybe deal with the mental health aspect a little bit more, because I also think, and this is something I would ask you, that do you also think that with the tools that you've used, meditation or these experiences that you've had, could they have exacerbated your mental health problem because you have a sense of unity? I've had this amazing experience. Then you come back to the material world and you're like, I want that. I want to be there. I want that. Boom.
That's where the work is.
Exactly.
I mean, I was actually wearing retreat in April, actually, but there's a sort of Stephen Wright, who's sort of great. He's a writer on spiritual matters. And he was always, he says pretty much, exactly that you've got to this sort of dualistic separation between, say, going to a sacred space.
Yeah.
So I think in one of his recent letters he was talking about Iona, actually, but it can be anywhere. So I've been up to Sammy Ling, which is a Buddhist monastery up in Scotland.
And the borders.
Yeah, wonderful temple. I can highly recommend a visit.
Beautiful.
Particularly if you're wanting a retreat for a few days.
Did you go on a silent retreat?
Sorry?
Did you go on a silent retreat or was it an arranged kind of?
It wasn't. I'm not sure I could actually cope with a silent retreat. It was a bit looser than that. But it was. It's very easy to feel sort of mystical sense of unity and everything in the temple because it's set up for that. I mean, it's amazing space, you know, it's sort of the candles and the Buddha statue and the atmosphere and it's wonderful. And then obviously you have to come back to the pandemonium of everyday life. And you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
We have this dualism, don't we? Where you have these spaces where it's very easy to feel spiritual,
yeah,
and then everyday life just seems profane, whereas actually I think the work is, and this is something I'm definitely a bit rubbish at, quite honestly, still it's bringing those two worlds together and seeing that actually the everyday is just as spiritual as the sacred space in its own way.
Do you think that the reason for your book then is kind of based on your journey and trying to coalesce both of those aspects together? Yeah.
Well, sure. I mean, the book was more focused on, it was more focused on presenting some of this stuff in a way that someone who's not committed, interested, but not committed to either side would be willing to take these things a bit more seriously as something, not just as a scientific curiosity or whatever, but as some aspect of the person that might be a useful resource. And my focus was on the future in general. So the last two chapters were a bit experimental, and they deal with some of the problems we've got and are facing in the immediate and longer term future.
Absolutely.
But also how things like this sort of mystical experience might help people cope better. But it really started from those personal experiences of mine, where I thought, and I'd noticed the converse as well. So I've had, I've known quite a few people who've suffered from quite significant mental health problems. And I have noticed that people who are staunchly materialistic and, well, let's say it, atheist, seem to not cope quite as well, because they refuse to look inside themselves and tap those additional capacities, which you're talking about. It's not really faith, it's experience. I know from experience.
Exactly.
Can actually make a massive difference. And it's often very frustrating for me. It's often very frustrating for me if I am talking to someone, with mental health problems who takes a staunch, who refuses to look at things like transpersonal and mystic experience. I think you are tying one hand behind your back in terms of recovery, because you're not taking advantage of an inner capacity your body, mind and consciousness, and dare I say its soul, actually has.
Yeah.
And that comes to me because I think even my most sort of atheist moments, I sort of experimented with atheism, like you experiment with a lot of things in university, but when I was sort of 17, 18 and during my early 20s at points, I was a very Dawkins level.
Oh, were you really?
Yeah.
Hardline materialist. Richard Dawkins was your hero.
Well, I mean, I've still got a lot of sympathy for his writings, but I think what I came to realize was that a lot of these writers, and Dennett actually, Daniel Dennett, a lot of what these writers had, they seemed to have a form of tunnel vision, because they were so scared of letting anything
in,
that this passionate hatred of, it tends to be focused on traditional religion. And I tend to think that mysticism has a complicated relationship with religion, actually. Again, I was talking to Mark Vittman about this, but it all gets lumped together. So the paranormal, the mystical, anything that is within a million miles of religion is supposed to be, completely, amputated from our very beings and not souls, because you don't have any souls, and I think that ultimately is quite destructive, actually. Yeah. Because it doesn't, it's like saying, I use this analogy in the book, it's like if someone came along and said, right, sexuality is 100% wrong, you can't feel any sexual feelings, you should be ashamed of yourself. I mean, that's actually happened in the past. Let's face it, with sort of various kind of puritanical movements.
Absolutely.
But just, they've never been very successful for obvious reasons. And I think there's an analogy there. I think a lot of these things are very deep instincts, and they've been around for a long time, since, we evolved, basically. Millions of years, perhaps, well, certainly hundreds of thousands of years, but I suspect that the precursors of these sorts of experiences, it wouldn't surprise me if animals had them at all. We're not talking about, I'm not coming from a strict, sort of traditional religious position, which probably annoy another set of people, but I think. Like I said, you've got mystical experience, and then you've got formal institutionalized religion. And although I think you could say that a lot of religions have as their basis mystical experience.
Absolutely. And certainly Catholicism has got, you know, it's...
Yeah.
They say that they're against mediumship. I wrote an article in Paranormal Daily News about, and I think it was called Catholic Church Accepts Mediums, even though they... And because they'll say... And I've had this chat with... Because I was brought up a Catholic and I was in, you know, junior seminary at one point, and I spent, my uncle was a monk, spent times in the monastery. I had mystical experiences in the monastery, and I didn't realize that the Catholic Church has had a you know, a separate organization that investigates these experiences. And as long as you're Catholic, they'll say that you have got, you know, we don't refute the gifts of the Spirit, but we refute, obviously, conjuring and all this kind of stuff. And that goes back to the Didache in the early 15th century. And there's so much to it. So I do think that even in Native American cultures and other religious cultures of Buddhism, they do have an acceptance of a mystical experience, albeit they may label it in a different way.
They do, although, I mean, it's like, for example, mystics have often, even in Catholicism, taken the risk of being labeled heretics. I mean, Meister Eckhart, I think he was being sent to trial, and I think he would have been burnt at the stake if he hadn't died. But Meister Eckhart was a very great medieval mystic, but basically the organized church didn't like very much what he was saying, so he annoyed them. But actually, it's interesting you should say that, because in the Church of England, I was told, I think Stephen actually mentioned this, mystical experience is considered somewhat dodgy, believe it or not. And you're just supposed to believe in the doctrines, and
that's it.
And you're not supposed to actually experience these things. And I found that, frankly, as I went to a Church of England school, but I wouldn't consider myself Church of England. But I found that quite strange, because to me, it's very obvious the links between sort of mystical experience and religious beliefs are very, very obvious.
It's interesting. You're going to love this story. So when I was a young kid and I was in the monastery, as I say, my uncle was a monk, I was in a Redemptorist monastery, and I spent most of my youth there, always in my holidays there. I was part of their junior missionary. And I remember, and I stayed in this, in the attic rooms in Canoel Hill in Perth, and the attic, they're terrifying. Right, they're really good, because it's really everything else is nice in the monastery. It's like a castle. It's beautiful. It's amazing. And as a young kid, you know, from very young, I spent all my holidays there, and I was up in the attic. And it's kind of scary. I remember I was bursting for a pee one night, and I kind of thought, right, I don't have. There's no bathrooms or anything in the room. I mean, this is a monastery where the monks lived way back in the 17th century, right? So it's still old, and you got to run down a corridor to get to the toilet. And of course, when you're a young kid and it's dark and everything moves and stuff like that, and I went running to the toilet. There was nobody on the floor. I was right in the attic rooms. There was nobody there. But as I'm running, going to the toilet, I see a monk literally come from the bottom row and come through and come out and kind of look at me and then disappear into another area room. Now, there was no doors there. This was just like a wall. I didn't recognize it. So I waved and I'm like, hello, father. You know, it kind of there is a young boy. Hello, father. Nothing, just no connection, just straight through, just as if it looked at me and went, you know, you can say there's a trick in my imagination, whatever else, but it was so very real. Well, here was the thing. I spoke about this in the refectory the next morning, and then I was brought up in front of the rector of the time, and he showed me pictures of these monks from back in the day. And I pointed out to one that had passed way back in years gone by, and identified the person who it was. And they say, well, that person had kind of is gone. And then, and interesting, then you get the lecture as a young boy of evil and how the other side is dangerous and how you shouldn't look at these experiences and that you should always then... I mean, I went back to, you know, for the next few nights and everything, I had rosary beads, you know. But that's the interesting thing. I had a mystical experience that had an element of evidence to it, but then was blood, you know, pulled into... This is not good. You shouldn't do this. You shouldn't delve in this. You shouldn't allow this to happen. There's evil things that are out there as well. And I was terrified.
I mean, that's so fascinating. I mean, if that had happened to me, I think I would have definitely classed that as a ghost experience. And it's quite interesting. But again, it shows the transience between, say, a ghost experience and a mystical experience.
Yes.
But I think that's a nice illustration, because I think one of the problems with parapsychology, psychical research, is we're caught between a rock and a hard place. So we're caught between the rock of scientism, which says it's a load of old nonsense.
Yes, that's true.
And the hard place of, I'm not going to say always fundamentalist religion, but it can certainly be fundamentalist religion.
Well, I think it is. Says, I think that's quite a good analogy.
That says anything that doesn't, any sort of supernatural or paranormal thing that doesn't have the approval of the church is definitely bad for your teeth, basically. And you know, so I think this is a problem that we have with psychical research, that I think potentially, actually, both science and religious institutions have a lot to learn from psychical research and parapsychology.
Absolutely.
But we have to overcome these taboos. And we are, you know, we've sort of skated over what are taboo areas for some people in this talk, haven't we? So we've talked about the relationship between mystical experience and mental illness. That's one of them. We talked about post-materialist views. That's another taboo. You know, sort of, and I think this is one of the issues that we face today with these extreme polarizations. We've got all these sort of very dogmatic camps. And
I think also as well, you know, Matt, we have polarization within parapsychology and transpersonal psychology.
Oh, yeah.
Because we have a division between parapsychology and science and you know, and this the hard problem of consciousness and experience. But at the same time, we've got the same kind of division within transpersonal psychology, which is about obviously lived experience and the experiential process. And what we can learn and the knowledge that we get from parapsychology, there seems to be this division. We need to create this bridge.
Yeah, I mean, it's like The Life of Brian, if you understand that reference.
Watched that a couple of weeks ago again. I love that. Always look at the Brian.
There's a great quote, actually, from Alan Gould book's just over there, actually. I could grab it, but he sort of talks
about...
Yeah, sure,
if you want to grab it, it's fine.
Let's grab it.
Yeah, let's do it.
A book, I think it might be backwards on your thing, but it's from a book called Mediumship and Survival, where the late Alan Gould, who very sadly died at the end of last year, he talks about how... He basically talks about how different groups in parapsychology and outside reject different bits of evidence on faith.
Yes.
And he says, so it's not just, say, neuroscientists who have this attitude to ostensible evidence for survival. Some parapsychologists from the experimental camp tend to take this view of the data gathered by other parapsychologists, those interested in the topics of this book. So he's talking about survival stuff, basically. Some spiritualists would accord a like negligent dismissal to the findings of neuroscience. And he finishes by saying, I do not like this rejection of data on faith. It is at best a not very honest way of protecting oneself from the labor of having to adjust one's opinions.
Oh, that's good.
So what he's saying there is essentially we need to take it all in, however difficult it is, and even if there seem to be contradictions, and see if we can build a bigger picture that makes sense of a lot of these experiences. And I mean, he's talking specifically about survival stuff there and neuroscience, but actually I think it's true of all of this. So there's so much dogma out there. I watch debates about these various things, and on various polarized factions, and lots of people are making assumptions, assumptions they don't even know they're making. And I think we need to step back and we need to have better dialogues with each other, which is a real tall order, but something that we need to keep trying to do. And just take a really broad view view of the data and from a humanistic point of view. And I think that's one of the points I tried to make in the book, because we can discuss this as a later point if you like. But one of the things that...
Oh, there's going to be, ladies and gentlemen, there's going to be a part three. We're only scratching the surface. I wanted to get into free will and all sorts. We haven't got into that yet. So there is going to be a part three.
Great. So, but I will say that one of the reasons why I wrote the book was that I think that we're in great danger of becoming very dehumanized.
Yeah.
And that comes, I think, with worshipping technology too much. Don't get me wrong. I use technology all the time, including AI. But I think there's a difference between using it and accepting it as being useful and worshipping it and trying to turn yourself into a machine.
Something else.
So this is a whole debate we can have next time. But I think
absolutely. And it's funny because I just watched someone yesterday that said, make sure you thank your AI agent, right? So that you don't get affected when the apocalypse comes. And I'm like, what? Utilize the air. Oh, and thank you very much for helping me. Please don't eradicate me. It's like, it's so scary. We're losing our sense of connection to who, I believe, who we really are. And I think this is a great thing about the book is, and again, on our next episode, we've got to unpack this whole free will aspect. We've got to unpack, you know, what we can learn from our mystical experiences to in the world. Yeah. Because I think we get a lot of mystical experiences from the other side that's saying, you know, literally you're going down the wrong path. Things need to change. You know, ignorance is not bliss. And, you know, so that there is so much that we got to talk about.
Well, this is it. I mean, it might be a little bit selfish because I don't want to live in a horrible depersonalized future.
No.
I think we need to pay attention to these sorts of things, because it's an avenue to rehumanize the future. So rather than letting, say, extremely rich tech bros direct how our future is going, I think we need to, frankly, take back control a little bit and start thinking, what kind of future do we want? We want it to be nicer, don't we? I want it to be nicer.
I absolutely do. Yeah.
But I think what a good starting point is to broaden our outlook, you know, and try and take in these exceptional human experiences in the broadest possible sense and look at them not just for what they can teach us about the brain or whatever, but also how they can help rehumanize us and make us more alive and joyful.
And I think that's where transpersonal psychology and parapsychology can work hand in hand.
Yeah.
In moving toward that future, I think, you know, parapsychology as a science in itself can bridge into that transpersonal experience, and we can learn from it and try to make the world a better place.
100%, because I think there are obviously lots and lots of reasons for the sort of geopolitical mess in which we find ourselves.
Oh, geez, yeah.
But I have to say that I think one reason is this radical sense of disconnection. And
I think Steve Taylor espouses that. He talked about in his recent one. He's new. I mean, that guy spouts books out like muffins out of a bakery. but his books are great. And he does talk about this. He talks about this disconnection.
Yes, and I it's something that I see everywhere, and I think it causes a lot of suffering. And like I said earlier, I think one of the problems is if you're just plugged into, you know, the industrial consumer mainstream and that is your life, and you have no other perspective, you don't have access to those transpersonal resources which could actually stop you, reduce...
We're on the cusp of mass transpersonal crisis.
I think we are. I mean, we can talk about the issues of whether, you know, you can get that beyond that in a sort of in a mass way. I mean, I've talked to people like Jem Bendel who are quite skeptical about some of those ideas. But I definitely think that it's what we're talking about, sort of mystical experience, transpersonal experience. I think they are such a crucial way of potentially improving well-being. That sort of natural awakening Steve Taylor's talking about, whatever you want to call it.
is a segue into our next conversation as well. Yes. We've gone over again, which is obvious we were going to do that, but it is going into clinical parapsychology and how transpersonal clinical parapsychology has a potential key to living greater and living to, you know, your full potential, if you like. Matt, thank you for joining me for part two. This has been phenomenal. Again, definitely part three. Ladies and gentlemen, Matt, get your book up for people can see. This is the book you want to get. I'm really enjoying it.
It is backwards, but never mind.
Fully PDN supported, endorsed, great book. I'm loving it. I've got it on Kindle as well, and I have it here. So if you love it that much, then get it in all forms. Matt, what's the final thoughts maybe you want to say about your book, or even a little bit about mental health that we can finish with? And anybody who's out there, please connect with us on Paranormal Daily News, and also to and Matt's website and his great podcast as well, What Lies Beyond, about the book. Matt, final thoughts?
Yeah, I think all I'd say is that in my going back to my visits to Sammy Ling, quite often when I go up there, I meet people who are at a crossroads in their life. So they might be dealing with, say, a very serious, maybe even terminal illness, but also they might have lost their job. They might be simply have a sense of that their life is in transition. And I think that's the point. It's almost, you can call it a liminal point in their life, really. And that's certainly my experience when an opportunity for engagement with, say, spiritual experience, transpersonal experience becomes very important, actually. So what I would say to people is, if you are at that point and you're not sure about this stuff, is feel free to explore and find what works for you, and look deeper into that potential for experience and transformation. I think that's what I'd finish with.
That's awesome, Matt. Thank you so much for being with me. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on Deadly Departed. Just remember as well that Matt, Lloyd Auerbach, and all of our guests hopefully will be doing short master classes within our private community, where you can actually learn from them and then get engaged with them and get the book. Certainly, you know, Matt, I hope, is going to do a short master. He probably, I've just thrown him right under the bus, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. So I don't think I even asked him yet. So Matt will be doing a small master class in PDN, which we're hopefully will get his message out to a lot more people as well. So if you're listening out there and you're not a member of our private community, then make sure you go on paranormaldailynews.com. Join us. There's great parapsychologists in there. Remember as well that we've got our journal that'll be coming out soon, plus our other new magazine. There's so much more happening. Plus, we're launching PDN books. We've got great guests coming up. Dr. Marjorie Willicott. Hopefully, we've got Steve Taylor back on. Gabrielle, one of our tutors at Aleph as well, who's has done a great paper on AI. There's so much that we can look at and we can identify. And I'm really excited about bringing Matt back, because we have not even touched scratch the surface of what we can. I'm still in awe of some of the quotes I've heard recently about free will. I really want me and Matt to get in and really unpack that as well.
Yeah.
But get the book, read it. If you've got questions, send us in questions. Is there something that you don't agree with?
Yeah.
We want to know. If you want to challenge What Lies Beyond, then challenge it.
Bring it on.
Challenge my book, challenge him. Right? This is great. Matt, thank you for joining me, my friend. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back very soon. Have a great day, great evening, great morning, wherever you are. This is PDN. This is Deadly Departed. We're signing off. Please. God bless.
Thank you.